week on the Dot to Dot podcast, I talked to John Henry Pickup, who is currently Managing Director of Butlins. We recorded this during lockdown, and so some bits go a little bit funny where Zoom couldn't keep up with us. Hope you enjoy listening. So hello, today, he's going to laugh. No, he's not laughing at me. I have
just smiling.
John Henry Pickup, who I've known. How long have I known you for?
4 years now, amazingly. Time flies.
It does. And I've got a seven-year-old in the background. It's not helpful. I'm going to leave her. What? Sorry, she's really off-putting. Tell me, who are you? What are you doing?
I am the managing director for Butlins. For those people who don't know it, apparently there's 3% of the population who don't. Is a UK-based holiday resort. Yeah, 3% of the population only don't know Butlins. We have about a quarter of a billion turnover and about 5,000 people who work for us. It's interesting because it's only three locations, and the bit that amazed me the most when I first went around was just the scale of the place. So if you look at Skegness, it's the resort's a mile long it's incredible. Absolutely incredible. So the scale of it is just it's just astounding.
It's quite appalling. I haven't been to any of them, isn't it?
Well, I think that it's an interesting one. If you look at the halcyon days of the business, certainly through the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, and the early part of the 60s, when there were 27, I think, in total at one point. It was very much an egalitarian UK thing to do, and Billy Butlin was a real pioneer in the way that he did things. You know, even if you look at his marketing back in the late 40s, a week's holiday for a week's wages was very much what he went for. And so he always stood for innovation, value for money, having an egalitarian product that was open and available to everybody.
What was his background?
He grew up in Canada. Was in the military for a period of time. Yeah, that's what he found with the UK. He said that compared to Canada, where holiday camps, as he would have described them, were, you know, lovely, big, outdoor, family-oriented, full of activity-type places. When he came to the UK, he said the British seaside was drab and horrendous, and B&Bs were terrible, and landladies, because principally they were then, were grouchy, and there was nowhere to go when it rained. So he wanted to make something that was very much available for everybody, but also kept the family entertained throughout the day, throughout the night, and it worked whether it was sunny or rainy. And I think over time that probably got lost a little bit. So we're working hard at the moment to try to capture the essence of that, because it's all there, and really be clear on what Butlins is and what it means to British population and holiday goers in the 21st century.
So for me, when you first mentioned Butlins, I've got friends that have been to Butlins, but I'm sure, I think I remember you saying actually when you started considering the role, some of your friends had sort of brought up Heidi High.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. How is that? Does that have any reference point within the business at all?
Only in the sense of we have a heritage library of everything that had happened with the business for a long period of time, and in terms of what it delivers now and where that comes from, I don't think that has any relevance. And in fact, if you think about the program itself, I think if you're, you know, I'm 48 and I vaguely remember it in the background of my childhood years, but if you're below the age of 40, Heidi High means nothing to you other than what your parents have told you. And so it's a strange one, because what we're aiming to do through our lovely marketing team is to make sure that we're clear on what it stands for now and what its relevance is now, because it can't be the only reference point for a business that is as busy as it is right now in 2020 that somebody harks back to a TV program that was on in the 1980s. It makes no sense to me. So that's our responsibility as a team. I think that's our fault. We haven't yet identified what the right message is and what the connection is to guests and potential guests in 2020. And that's what we have to do now.
But to be fair, I mean, it's difficult to know, isn't it? When, because I've obviously learned a lot more about business because you've been in the business. Mm. And maybe my awareness has also been concentrated on certain things. So I think the advertising, I've said to you, I think the advertising is great now. But maybe that's because I'm biased. I don't know, because I'm very aware of it. But aside from Butlins, this is about you. So how did you go? Where did you grow up?
So I'm from Blackpool originally, and I lived in Blackpool up until I was 18. And so, you know, being by the sea was quite an important part of my life in the past. So I lived with my brother and my mum and dad all of that time on that coast. So I grew up there.
Your mum's quite amazing, isn't she?
Well, I think my mum's brilliant. I mean, she's a career civil servant. My dad, who died about 18 months ago, he ran his own business for many years. My brother worked in that business as well. So career discussions growing up were really interesting because you've got a career civil servant on one hand and an entrepreneur on the other. They're opposite ends of the risk spectrum. But yeah, my mum did some brilliant stuff within the civil service. Some quite difficult things as well. I mean, she got an MBE as a result of that. I think she's great, and she's still a force to be reckoned with now, even at 76.
I'm glad to hear it.
She won't be happy that I've said her age out loud. Sorry, Mum.
Yeah, but I might have to erase that bit.
So she'll be fine. So she's been there for forever, really. I think I was always of a view when I got to 18 and went to uni that I was probably going to travel around, and which is sort of what I did. I mostly, you know, I lived in Central Europe. I spent some time in China. Spent some time in California.
I'm interrupting because it's delaying and then catching up. I know we all know that I interrupt anyway. That's one of my
tendencies. I lived in Prague in the Czech Republic for 5 years, but I worked across Central Europe. So I was working in Poland, Czech, Slovakia, and Hungary when I was working for Tesco. That's right.
Yeah. Well, you had some really interesting situations to deal with, didn't you, when you were out there?
Yeah, I think that I'd recommend to anybody. Obviously, everybody's circumstances is different, but I think if you get an opportunity to live and work in a different country in a different culture, I think it's a brilliant way to stretch your mind. And it challenges lots of the things that you just automatically assume and probably become a bit lazy about when you're sat in a normal environment that you get used to. So I guess one of the things that really struck me first and foremost, aside from the fact that I couldn't speak Czech, and it's really hard to learn as well, and we're not very good at languages, are we, as Brits? But I had a team of about 14 at one point, and I think only about three of them spoke any English at all.
That's really hard.
So imagine a team meeting for a full day. So what I wanted them to do was, I said, right, you speak in Czech, and my assistant, who had a really tough job, she would just sit next to me and translate what was happening in the conversation. Wow. And then when I wanted to say something, she'd talk back to them. Same when we went to the shops. So I'd have a conversation with a store manager through her. And that's it's amazing how fast you get to clarity on what you're trying to say, and how you use simple phrases, and how you shrink the amount of words that you use, which is not a bad thing to do anyway, because I think people probably use about a third more words than they actually need to in conversation generally. And you can't use any slang expressions or anything that's metaphorical that doesn't that doesn't fit.
That's really weird, isn't it? Because I remember doing a psychometric, but there was a guy who was being, I had to profile him for Cadbury. Cadbury. But it was, he was basically, he'd been flown over from Russia for this meeting. So he'd never been to England before. And there I had to sit, I had to shove this psychometric under his nose partway through. You know, you've experienced it, John. So two, three hours worth of interviewing and a few psychometrics. And this one psychometric, which I personally don't use, but I used to use at my old company, one of the questions on it was, do you blush?
And really?
Yeah. And I came out of my room, and that was when I was working with lots of other psychologists. Can you imagine what a weird place that was? And one of the more experienced psychologists asked me what I was doing, and I told him, and he said he will call you in when he gets to the question, do I blush? And I was like, really? And he's like, yep, there's no translation for it. And I was like, really? And so sure enough, head pops out the door.
What does this mean?
Yeah, it's amazing, those things that we just take for granted. I mean, it's a bit like most snow thing, isn't it? However many words they've got for snow, and we've got one word for snow, but the nuances that you can express in different languages by having those words or not having those words is immense.
Absolutely. It's such a strange thing to try to get your head around as well. And it, even just basically, I still remember a really interesting conversation about, we were working out an implementation strategy for something we were changing in the shops, and I wanted to make sure we were landing things on time. And I talked about health checks. And when Nora, who was my assistant, translated, I could see there's some confusion going around the room. And she translated a trip to the doctors, because health check didn't make any sense to them in terms of what they were doing. But then they're like, well, what? Why are we?
Why
don't you have a trip to the doctors in the middle of re-merchandising? which is a completely reasonable question to ask. But yeah, I thought nothing of health check as being just something that you would see as implementation and compliance.
But what you've said there is really interesting as well. I was having this conversation with someone earlier today, is that we need to read those nuances, don't we? So in that sense, of course you need to read the body language and the expressions, because you can't understand the language. But in any situation, we're taking in that information all the time. And when we're on Zoom all the time, it creates a massive barrier to that, because you don't see someone as they walk out of a meeting look fed up or worried. You don't see someone who's sort of, you know, who seems angry or frustrated. You might pick up on those things during a meeting, but those are the things that surround the meeting, or they're when someone isn't talking, or so it's interesting how Zoom has impacted working from that perspective. But so what remind me, I should remember, but remind me when you were in China and why.
So again, I was with Tesco. It was 2006 where I spent a couple of periods of time in China. And what we were trying to work out at the time was how to organize the Tesco business across China. The Tesco business was a joint venture. That's the only way you could move into China at the time, as a foreign company. But because of the nature of the country and what it was that we were trying to do, which was say same as Tesco in the UK, the scale and complexity of that was just huge. So we were trying to organize, what is the best way to set ourselves up? What should be local decisions and what should be central decisions for China? And how do you organize a supply chain where you've got, you know, at the same time of year, you've got people wearing ski jackets in the north and flip-flops and swimming shorts in the south. So the complexity of that was hard. So we were trying to, I was working with the Chinese team to try and organize how they set themselves up for success. which is fascinating because I got a tour around the country with the different shops and how they worked, which was brilliant.
I mean, it's just such a vast country, isn't it? It is mind blowing, and I've only travelled through the south west corner, and even doing that, coming across, I learnt my very, very, very basic Mandarin to sort of get me my pleases and my thank yous and one, two, three, or four, or something like that. And I can't even remember them now. And my hellos. But then you'd go into a different region and they'd have a different dialect, which wasn't Mandarin. And so I was traveling with a lady who was Australian, who spoke Mandarin. And she would most of the time be able to translate, or if I went off on my own. It's amazing also how much you can communicate without language as well, when you have eye contact, things like that. But to the point, we went up to one mountain village and she couldn't understand a word they said either. I was like, well, this is a whole load of help, isn't it? not that she was coming with me as a translator, but you know, that everyone just looks at you like you've got five heads, and to them you have, because you know, from the west. And at the I was there in 2001, and I think even between 2001 2005 it changed dramatically.
I'm sure it'd be, it's probably unrecognizable now. I loved it. I really enjoyed it. And ironically enough, Oscar, my eldest, is living there now and enjoys it loads. He's in Chengdu, which was, you know, going back to your scale point, really fascinating when you see the contract and where he's going, and it says medium-sized Chinese city, 8.5 million people. So... You know, it's just absolutely wild. A medium-sized Chinese city is something that's virtually the size of everything in London inside the M25, which is just wild, isn't it?
It is. It's absolutely amazing. I found it absolutely fascinating as a country, and beautiful.
Yes.
Stunning scenery. And I know, again, I only saw a tiny fraction of it, but I was blown away by the scenery. But then in contrast again, California.
That was during Tesco and Easy period, when I just set that business up. So I went over there with my boss at the time to have a review of that, because the business that we were doing in Central Europe was based around small stores. We were competing quite heavily with Lidl at the time, so we were facing them with that size of shop. That was the same size of shop that they were setting up in California. So we went over to try and compare notes. And it was it's amazing, the US, because we speak the same language, you assume that we're going to be similar, and actually it felt much more different being in California in the way that people behaved and the way they interacted than it did being in Central Europe. It's easy to forget that, I think.
No, I mean, it is, and it's bananas. And I remember when I was doing a lot of work with BP in the US and going to Houston a lot and going out to restaurants with colleagues in the evening, and the waiter and waitresses couldn't understand what I was saying. And I'm sitting there thinking, hang on, I was just speaking English, but they couldn't understand me. And it's literally my colleagues would have to say what it was I wanted. Or even when my brother lived in New York, when we phoned for pizza, again, this was late 90s, and I do think even the US has become more, apart from Trump, has become more outward-looking, a lot more outward-looking since then. But I have to put on an American accent to get the pizza ordered right, because otherwise...
I imagine that was fun. Go on, do it. Do your pizza voice.
No, I'm not doing it. I feel more at home in California, I think. But the work thing is really different as well. So maybe that's more what you're referring to, because I know that when I've done work in the States, it's felt very foreign the way we do work in the UK. Etiquette, rules, norms, the fact that you can just fire someone at the drop of a hat, it just creates a completely different culture.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. I think California is also very different from the rest of the US, in the way that works. And the influence of big tech on California's behavioural norms is probably a bit, I mean, some of it's remarkable, but some of it's a bit frightening. When you take that level of innovation and you put it into an environment where you have very little, relatively, regulation, you can see some of these extremes of behaviors that we get and we come across, which is tricky. I don't know whether one has to come with the other, whether you get that scale of innovation because it's unbounded, or whether
it's not fire alarm.
It's not the fire alarm. Yeah, my Friday afternoon fire alarm test. No, that's not that. Don't worry. I don't know whether one begets the other. Probably not. I don't think you should be in a position where the only way you get innovation is if you have no rules. It did feel quite alien.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like when I'm in, and I think retail in the States, I haven't worked in retail in the States, but I've had conversations in the workplace about retail in the States. And I think retail in particular is very different from retail in the UK or in Europe.
Yeah.
So that probably feels more alien as well. But what's interesting about California is you've got Hollywood, which dramatically shapes part of the culture. You've got big tech, you've got wine country, and they're all, from an economic and cultural perspective, hugely influential.
Yeah.
It's an interesting place. But now you reside in the UK. And what did you study at uni?
Economics.
That's right. Where did you study that?
So I did economics at York in 1990.
And then I did
my MBA at Warwick in 2001. Just around the time of the Enron scandal and...
I was experiencing that.
And the collapse of Arthur Andersen.
I was working for Andersen Consulting at the time.
Yeah, the Arthur Andersen bit was remarkable because... Whilst I was at business school at Warwick, they ran the Arthur Andersen Business School program. So they ran the Arthur Andersen MBA. And so some of the people that we ended up in joint classes with and in evening seminars and things like that were at Arthur Andersen. And one day they were there and the next day they were just gone.
It was a really odd
period of time, because you can combine that with the initial dot-com explosion, which was also then. There was a period of time when going to a decent business school and ticking off MBA and therefore getting a massive pay rise and a great job was a bit like shooting fish in a barrel, and that really changed that year. So we had people on the course with me who, you know, they'd be talking to students from the year before and the year before that, they'd be getting 4, 5, 6 offers. And then suddenly there was nothing out there. And I think that challenges people to think and work differently.
It's a bit like where we're at now, actually. But I mean, obviously now the scale, we'll look back and say it's much more dramatic. But we're kind of living it at the moment, aren't we? So I don't think we fully realise how dramatic it is.
No, and I don't know what the other side of this looks like, because unlike, I suppose, 2001, 2008, you go back to 97, so on and so on, you can do loads of those. This isn't a classic global economic cycle, is it? This is something very different from that. And the bit that we don't know yet is what happens economically at the other side of that, that everyone's talking about V shapes versus U shapes and all of that type of stuff.
I would argue this anyway, because I take the psychological view of economics. It's and we've had these conversations before. I think it is relatively unpredictable, not based on, because you can't base it all on numbers.
Rational market behavior, perfect information and supply and a demand curve. It doesn't really work like that, you know, human behavior. And I'm sure that's part of the reason why, you know, we talked about behavioral economics and the the prevalence of that in the past few years.
I get all excited if we start talking about that.
It is, but it's probably no coincidence that right now, when there's so much more of a challenge of the capitalist model and what that evolves into, and globalization and the impact on people, the level of equality versus inequality, particularly in developed societies, that you start turning more to, is the capital system and perfect information in competitive markets really going to deliver what you need to deliver, or do we have to do things differently? And the answer isn't communism, by the way, because there isn't a description of how that works. I don't think that's my take so far. But I do think we need to think differently and behave differently. And I think there'll be an expectation on people who run businesses and lead teams to work in a more human way, to work in a more values-based way. We've talked about it for a while. You can still see areas where you can succeed by being purely KPI or P&L driven. I think that's likely to become less, and consumers will take their pounds elsewhere if you're the type of business that treats people badly.
Yeah, well,
customers or team.
I hope that's true. But what's interesting about you is that, because clearly very, very bright, but you are an economist in terms of your academic training, but you've always had the, since I met you, I assessed you, I would say, you know, you have that long-term view and that people view, and even when it's not popular or not seen as the right way to do it, you've stuck by the longevity of investing in people, and it does pay off. It always pays off. But you know, it's difficult when you're working under circumstances where you have ownership or what have you, who have a short-term view and a very strongly economically driven view. But you manage to combine those things, and I think it's really, really nice. It's nice is the wrong word, but for you to be at Butlins, because you've got the opportunity in an environment that is very values-based to express your values.
Yeah.
Which is that you actually care about the people that you work with. Hmm. Although I don't think enough of your funny side shows, but I've told you that before. the work that I'm doing on the startup at the moment, it's very much going back to the basics of how we are human. And you know that I'm talking to, because you're very of that viewpoint as well. But it's interesting how it's brought it into laser focus. And I think even in global political leadership, people suddenly seeing the cracks far more. And you see someone like Jacinda Ardern, who may have an landscape to play in from sort of historical, bureaucratic, all that sort of political complexity sort of, but people like a friend of mine who's quite rebellious, who lives in New Zealand, says she doesn't mind following the rules because there's someone there who's giving her security and confidence it's the right thing to do. She's basically being human. But there's a great quote that she, there was a quote from her that I just posted on LinkedIn, and something like 30,000 people have looked at it, not liked it, looked at it. And that was basically she's in opposition to people saying she's not aggressive enough because she does believe that's the only way to be a leader.
Yeah.
And actually it's great. It's brilliant. It's what we need, but, I think it's what we need. I think it's what people will judge leadership more on, and corporates more on, like you say, based on that human side and the values.
I do hope so. And she is a really good example of what we're seeing of leading through a period of time that doesn't have a certain start or certain outcome. I think it's been great. And look, as you said, it's got to be easier to lead through New Zealand than it has to lead through the US, for example. But it doesn't mean it's simple. It doesn't mean it's easy in any way. I wouldn't want to be running a country for anything. You must make horrendous decisions every day. Even in somewhere as lovely as New Zealand, you must be making terrible decisions on a day by day basis. And what you've seen with New Zealand is something that you can apply to conversations that you have with people in your team. So I talk to managers, junior, as they're progressing through their careers, and say, you've now got to a point where you no longer get to make a simple decision about one thing that's right versus one thing that's wrong. What you end up with is you've got one set of complex information with good and bad points to it, or another set of complex information with good and bad points to it. You've got to pick one of them. And there isn't an obvious route which is right. That must be magnified, I don't know how many times, when you're leading a country. And so I don't think she's had an easy time. And I think what's really nice, if you look at the way she behaves on camera, that there's an innate level of comfort with who she is. And I was going to say confidence then, but I don't think that's right, because sometimes confidence can be misconstrued as being, I need to know all the answers. And I think that's utterly wrong. And I think it's quite a testosterone heavy male construct, that one, that says boys know all the answers, and we have to be robust, and we have to be leading the charge from the front, and we have to be bulletproof, and all of that type of nonsense. I think what's really nice with her, and what you see with her behavioral style, is in there she's just a person. And she doesn't know all of the answers. And, she cares very deeply about what it is that she's trying to achieve. And I think what's admirable that she has, which I fail to do a lot, which is that she seems to not take utterly personally conversations that she has. She'll listen to feedback that she gets, good and bad, and she takes a particular direction. And you couldn't get more of a juxtaposition with what's going on in the model in the US, because that model of leadership is a very different one. I don't want to call out one as being good and one as being bad, because that's not for me to do. But you can see the difference, and I can relate much more clearly to what she does and how she does that, because I'd follow her style. I'd find it very easy to work for her.
Yeah, it's interesting as well, something you said there. So you said that something she manages to do that you don't is to not let certain things bother her. But what's interesting is we don't know that.
That's true.
We don't. The people that follow you probably don't know that of you until you just said it.
That's also probably true.
And so we don't know the complexity of the emotions that she's experiencing behind the scenes. But I think we do definitely get a sense, or she projects a sense of authenticity.
That's right.
And I think I agree with you. I mean, I get on my high horse about hubris and all that sort of stuff. So I'm the same about confidence. But I think she's got that self-assurance that you feel like if she's got it wrong, she'll say, do you know what? You're right. I didn't get it right this time. What can we do about it? Rather than going, sticking our heels in, or putting her head in the sand, or trying to find lots of evidence to actually suggest she was right in the first place.
Yeah. And that is hubris, isn't it? That's when I remember having conversations with the chaps who did our leadership program when I was at Travelodge. He talked about strengths and strengths overdone, rather than necessarily strengths and weaknesses. And that's not just a language thing, to make sure that people aren't offended. You can have a strength that, if you push it too far in the wrong circumstance, that makes a problem for yourself. And having determination and certainty to go in a particular direction, and being resilient to batter off the things that get in your way, can be a strength. If it takes you to the point where you become tin-eared and intolerant, and you no longer listen to people, and you become very blinkered, and you're no longer adaptable because you can't change course when it's clearly not working, that's a terrible situation. So what started out as a real strength that gets you to the situation that you're in can then become hugely damaging if you just keep pushing that pedal.
Which is why psychological profiling is so important. She says stepping away from her career, but never mind.
I was going to say, have you got a little advertising banner to sit up?
Well, no, that's the thing. I'm trying to do less of that now because my time's taken up with other things.
I was going to say, you're an author and a podcaster these days, aren't you? Isn't that your role?
Oh, yeah, there's a whole load of other little projects going on as well. I'm a coach as well, remember?
Hey, you are a coach. That's true. You were always that.
Yeah. And always a bit bonkers. So, do you want to say where you've worked across your career?
Yeah, so I suppose principally, I've always been in consumer-facing businesses. So prior to business school, I worked for Aldi for a number of years, which was interesting development in the UK. And then post-business school with Tesco, Travelodge after Tesco. And then I was the CEO of Prezzo, the restaurant business for a couple of years, which was definitely a full-on multi-sensory experience.
Which I don't think is a thing you would say, but I know, and I know particularly around the people, the marketing strategy, the simplicity, what the tools that you gave people on the restaurant floor. Those are things that you, even though the hospitality business is full stop and now in tatters, those are things that you put in despite facing huge pressures.
Yeah, it was a tough time. It was tough, but I enjoyed, there was lots of it that I enjoyed. I built some good relationships as well with the people that I work with. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to manage to get some great people into the business. I hope they'll still speak to me because I hope they enjoyed it as well. But it was certainly hard yards. And I think you've talked before about learning circles and where you sit within those. And there was definitely a period of time where I was right at the outer extreme of what I was learning, and you can take on some damage.
Yeah. But without meaning to sound patronizing, which is going to now, you've incorporated all that learning into where you are now.
Well, I think it's vital. You often learn a lot more from the things that are very difficult than you do from the stuff that's easy. And so I suppose it taught me a number of things about things like warning signals and gut feel. And, you know, from my perspective, I can be a little bit focused on the data, and credibility comes from demonstrating that things happen, whereas actually using instincts and using experience is okay.
The irony is, John, and it's the irony of many of us, is, and I was actually having the same conversation with a creative, a comedian I was talking to earlier in the week. He referred to me as a creative, and I was like, I'm not a creative. I'd love to be a creative. I'm not a creative because I've hung on to the science always because it's given me confidence. And I think we're brought up through school and society to believe that we should hang on to that stuff. I was brought up through a Bachelor of Science, a Master's in Business, and a Master's in Science. So for me, that education was hang on to the data. And you were brought up through similar but different, you know, economics, an MBA, and so and then working in businesses where there's an expectation on that. But you and I are both very human-centric people. And so that's where the irony comes, is that it's particularly for you in a leadership role, is I see you as connecting so well with people, understanding, and even when you have to move people on, doing it in a way it's so respectful and you maintain those relationships because of the way you do it and the values that you use. Mm-hmm. And yet it still takes time to trust that mm-hmm. that is the right way to do, not the right way to do things, because you always do the things that, I've always seen you doing the things that are values-based, but that you can trust the less concrete aspects
yeah.
of information and data, because it is data, isn't it? I mean, gut feel, yeah. and it's still data, but we're brought up to believe it's not data to be relied on.
Yeah, that's true. And some of that probably plays back to the natural tendency that we often have, particularly if, because of course, from an insights point of view, I am driver, but I'm also analytical. That's my secondary trait. I suppose it's that imposter syndrome element that says, unless I can demonstrate this with objective data points, then is my opinion valid or not? And I need to, well, I think I have probably got away from that a bit more in the last couple of years.
I mean, from an observational perspective, which is much easier than from where you see it, is I would say definitely have. And I think the thing about COVID is it forced people to show their true colours. And in some cases, that meant they stepped up, like Jacinda Ardern, and without trying to blow smoke up your bottom, you as well. Whereas some people, it's made them crack. Because it's a high pressure situation. And so you, rather than thinking, I don't know, do I depend on my gut feel? You don't have a choice because you don't have the data.
No, absolutely. And, you know, if you are in a position where you rely on organizational systems to give you your answers, if you don't have any comfort with vagueness or uncertainty, you can see why people would crack in that situation. And I feel very much for anybody who's truly analytical, who has become very successful through reliance on analysis and data and systems, trying to lead through a scenario like this where nobody has answers and they change from 1 week to the next. Must be, must be catastrophic for the way you work. You have to then do things completely differently. I hope if people are in that situation, they manage to learn good things from it rather than it just take them down in a spiral. Because it's very tricky if your normal way of being successful and has been for a number of years is then, you know, ripped up and thrown out the window. That's hard to do.
What have been the best bits of your career?
I think I've put a little jigsaw together from that point of view. I don't think there's a common theme throughout all of these. I think what they are bits of a jigsaw that have put together where I sit now and why I feel quite happy doing what I do now. So if I think back to Aldi, I think what that business helped me to get a hold of was two things, pace of work and understanding what your business actually does. So it was high work rate, and I hadn't actually recognized that until I got into that business. So, you know, I'm still an early morning person. And I still get on with things from first thing in the morning now, but that was ingrained there because of the nature of how the business was growing. But also what the expectation of me was, you know, as I was training in roles, I had to do every role in the business. I have to sit on the till. I have to make sure that I clear the warehouse. I have to make sure that I fill the shelves. Because if, as a leader, I can't understand that, how can I possibly make decisions on how those jobs work? So, and that I still really believe in as an approach now. If you're not close enough to what goes on in a business, then I think it's very difficult to lead it. So I definitely took that was great. That really helped me. Tesco bit, I think, was the opportunity to work globally was brilliant. I think also seeing how the board worked in Tesco was also brilliant, because that's when I first saw a group of people who were completely candid with each other, to the point where it was quite shocking at one, but I thought, I'm having actually a fight here. And they weren't at all. There was no sense of malice. There was no emotion that came out of it, other than they were really tackling a subject really hard. And I thought that was amazing. So to be able to watch that happen, and how you make a team work in that way, was a great thing. There's loads of things you can say about Tesco that don't work so well. You know, the hard edge to it, the degree to which it felt a bit ruthless, it could be a bit cold. But nonetheless, I learned a huge amount from there. And those two things were great. So they were of my career. And also, the business was really, really successful for the whole period of time that I was there. By the way, I'm not claiming any credit at that point for the global success of Tesco. It just happened to be, I was fortunate because I was in a business that was really delivering. And that gives you a degree of confidence to try things and take risks and do new stuff. So that helped. Travelodge, I learned a lot about corporate finance, which I hadn't really seen or been involved in before, because when you're in Tesco, you're in a massive machine and you're nowhere near that. Where Travelodge, I got very close to that very quickly. We went through a corporate restructuring in 2012, where the business virtually ran out of money. So learning and understanding that was a great experience, and actually helped with the Prezzo bit. So I think when I combine those things, they've helped me do the things that matter to me now. So learning about getting close to the business and work rate is something that still matters. How a team works together is really a core part of me and the way that I work now, which was the Tesco element. And understanding different cultures also forces you to put yourself in the shoes of other people and say, right, why are they thinking what they're thinking, rather than just, well, I'm right and they're getting it wrong, so what's wrong with them? That's useful as well. And getting how governance of a business works and getting really close to that so that you can lead that through properly with the Travelodge experience, I think has been great. Put those things together, and it sort of gives me the comfort to work in the way that I work now. I mean, comfort in the sense that I'm confident that I know what I'm doing, and so therefore I can just be myself, which I think helps my team. And it certainly helps me. One of the things that matters to me most at work is happiness. And you know, if I can't do that, then I can't be happy. Those bits all come together. There aren't any, I didn't give you any specific milestones that said, oh, the best bit was when I delivered this or achieved that or whatever.
You know, we can say that, and you can pin things. And actually, I think it's wrong that we're brought up to believe that, because people suddenly have a defining moment in their life. And of course, if you nearly die, or, you know, face some sort of serious illness or whatever, yes, you are likely to have a defining moment. Or you lose someone close to you, those sorts of things. But even then, it's not necessarily something that everything suddenly becomes clear. And I think it's not fair on younger people for them to think that is the case. Because I know that when I was younger, I would look up and I would think, oh, you know, if I go traveling, for example, then I'll work out what I want to do with my life. But it kind of doesn't happen like that. Those aha moments, you don't have those aha situations either. It's evolutionary.
Yeah, not many of us are Paul, and not many of us are heading to Damascus. You know, it doesn't seem to, like, life doesn't normally happen in that way. How you do things seems to evolve, and there are two things that I remember, one life and one career, which helped to shape, I think, the way I feel and the way I think about stuff now. So, but neither of them were immediate and sudden in terms of how I then evolved. You evolve steadily over years because humans do. So I remember when, not that long before I left Aldi, I was promoted into a role which was too big for me at the time, and I got it wrong, and I got it wrong on the basis of the fact that I thought the way that I should succeed in that role is by demonstrating to everyone that I know more than everybody, that I'm smarter and I'm faster and I'm more experienced and all of that. And it was a disaster, and it wrecked that bit of my career with that company. And I still reflect on that really heavily now. And I think so. Sometimes you can win in the future. You can succeed in the future over a sustained period by having a bad experience early. And I think experiencing failure, for want of a better description, however you classify that, sports people can classify that really easily. I think in a work environment, it's much harder to do because it's more nuanced and it's not quite as easily defined. Whereas that still sticks with me. But at the time, it probably took me 5 years to figure out that that was important. Directly afterwards, I didn't suddenly behave in a different way at work as a consequence. In fact, for a period of time, I thought it was everyone else's fault. And I blamed a load of other people until I suddenly figured out I needed to, you know, have a word with myself and grow up a bit and figure out the fact that I'd done that and it was my accountability.
What sort of age were you then?
26.
It's funny because I think there's a feeling of, well, there was for me, invincibility. Is that the word, right word? Yeah. At that age?
Yeah.
It's kind of, I would look at CEOs because I was transitioning from being in management consultancy then to being back in psychology. Mm. And with my business hat on, I'd look at CEOs and I'd think, well, I could do that. Mm. And now, the work I do with CEOs, I think, how incredibly naive. But you see other 20-something-year-olds, they sort of strut the stuff and they look around like, oh, you're just old. And actually, I know the same things you know, but I'm young.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, it's almost like a rite of passage, isn't it? To go through that, to get burnt and to come out the other side, hopefully.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of value that comes from that by getting burnt and then coming out of the other side. You learn failure. You learn it and how that can hurt. And you learn a degree of, if you do it properly, you learn a degree of candid introspection so that you figure out what you got wrong. You might not do it immediately. I didn't. Like I said, I thought it was everyone else's fault. I thought my boss was a fool and you know, I could run rings around him and do his job. I'd love to be able to catch up with him now and just say, look, I must have been a bit of a nightmare because I was a bit of an idiot for about that time. It's a good question. I don't think he's anywhere in the UK or anywhere contactable at the moment, but that might be a valuable thing to do at some point from my own point of view. Okay. You're gonna remind me of that, aren't you? So that was useful, but it wasn't useful till ages afterwards. There was a point to my slightly rambling rant here, which was you saying that immediate, I go traveling and therefore I know the rest of my life. That's bonkers, isn't it? If you just look at that as a statement, it doesn't make any sense. And it's the same with stuff that you learn. You don't learn something and then immediately you do something differently, I don't think. I think it takes a period of time. And the same in my life. So in mid-2000s, I separated from the boy's mum, and that was a real revelatory period of time as well, because I'd never expected that to happen. You know, my parents were married from the age of 18 till the year, 18 months ago when my dad died, and I'd assume that's what you do. And it had also not helped me because it was a period of time where I determined, right, here's the route through, and this is what I'm going to deliver, and by when, and how we achieve that, and all of those things. And I'd become a bit control freaky, I think, and that wasn't particularly successful at that stage, work-wise or life-wise. And what that helped me do, and again, over a decade, was to think about, well, you know what? Stuff happens, and you can't control it all. And even if you wanted to, you can't. And so the best thing you can do is react in a way that you see best as a consequence of stuff happening. Because if you try to shape and bend to your will everything in the world, you'll fail. It just won't happen. Nobody can do that. And actually, as a consequence, I was probably quite a lot happier as a result once I'd figured through the fact that I hadn't failed in that scenario, I just got a bit better at accepting the fact that stuff happens in the world and the world is complex, and how I deal with it is the bit that's important, because that's key to whether I'm happy or not. I don't mean to sound like the Dalai Lama, but I think it was.
And the thing is, I mean, sorry, it's my fault for letting you continue. You've got great. I mean, you've got great life now. A great wife. I'm definitely a good drinker. great company. So, I didn't meet your previous wife, but I know that your current wife is definitely someone worth knowing. And so, you know, good things come, don't they, out of the bad things? But I mean,
definitely. I was really fortunate to meet her. You know, she's my she's my soulmate, and it's brilliant. I love our life, and I'm very, very fortunate to have met her. And I could easily have not have done, and I could easily have not have continued to be with her over that time, because, you know, I was processing getting divorced and what that meant, and my life and all those type of things. But, you know, thank the Lord, I am with her, and she's brilliant. So yeah,
it's, and you got married at the divorce, didn't you?
Yeah,
it's amazing. Right. Because your mum's got an MBA.
It was fab, exactly. You know, you've got to leverage these things, right? You know, so so that I was that was wonderful. It was a brilliant day, and 6 years ago now, which has gone very quickly. But yeah, that was fun.
What's interesting, just to sort of wrap up on, oh my goodness, yes, have you got a meeting now?
No, I'm all right, actually.
Quickly yeah. Wrap up then. So what's interesting is, well, a bit of a plug for my next book coming out next week. But the research that I've done in that on how important, from a psychological perspective, it's called daydreaming, or from an academic, but it's reflecting, visualization. And we have to give our brain the time and the space to reflect in order to process and come out with better answers. But unfortunately, we don't a lot of the time, because our world is so fast. And that's just case in point, that you have to let these things sink in, and you have to live with the discomfort of them for a little while. But if you do that, rather than shutting them down and never thinking about it again, or you get to a better place as a result of it.
Yeah, agreed. I think, you know, if you read someone like Leviton with The Organized Mind, there's only so much information you can process in any one day.
Which is like one page of his book, because it's...
yeah, it's quite dense, isn't it? Yeah, so I think it's very easy not to give yourself the time to do that, and also to be distracted by other stuff, and also to have run out of brain power by the end of it, because that's when people normally do it. They do it at the end, they think, I'll get to the end of the day, then I'll think about this. Yeah. Well, you're exhausted by that point, so you're not going to do a quality job of that. So that's why we don't talk at the end of the day, and I. It's a good thing.
I'm not dissing his book. His book is wonderful. Mm. It's amazing. And my laptop's going crazy in the sun. And I write down my most important things to do first thing in the morning. The thing I struggle with is that I also feel I want to exercise first thing in the morning, but then I feel like I'm wasting my thinking time. I know you can think and exercise at the same time, but when it comes to things like writing, I know I write best in the morning. So I have this thing where I have to weigh up, what do I do? Anyway, I'll wrap
exercise
up.
I'm much better first thing in the morning as well. So 30 minutes, that's what I do. Try and do different stuff each day. And then I'm into work, which is one thing that's been great about being at home, is that I don't do a drive into work all of the time. And so I will change my life in terms of how I organise that in the future.
Thank you for your time.
Not at all. It was fun.
Enjoy chatting to you, so that's likewise. No different. And hopefully people will have enjoyed listening to us prattle on.
We hope so.
Not that you prattle. Yours wasn't prattle. Mine was prattle. I'm now demonstrating.
Some of it definitely is. Don't worry. I don't feel offended. Some of it definitely is. And good luck with your new book. Another plug for you there. It wasn't even you having to plug that.
Yay! As I said there, I always enjoy talking to John. I hope you got a lot from listening to his experiences, which I personally find fascinating, the different countries, cultures and roles, but in particular, how candid he is about his experiences, his failures, his slip-ups, his learnings, and what he feels about life now. If you want to catch up on more of what I've done, please go to Fiona Murden, whether that's Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook. And details for my books are on the show notes. Thanks so much for listening.